Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is, well, my English name is Candy Massett. My errand name is Eagle Woman. I am a Mandan Hidatsa referral woman from North Dakota, and I work with the Indigenous Environmental Network.
Last week, there was a march on Washington and an encampment and everything. Can you tell us about all of that?
The whole entire Native Nations Rise march came out of the Standing Rock camps and what was happening in North Dakota. We wanted to make sure that even if, when we started planning, we didn't know for sure what was going to happen at the camp. It was prior to the forced removal. But we thought something bad might happen. And so we wanted to make sure that we were following up with something positive and with the next steps beyond just the camp, and into other people's communities. And so we started getting on phone calls. It was actually the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the Indigenous Environmental Network putting our heads together and saying, well, what should we do? And then the idea was born, and we just started having, you know, all of the calls and the different working groups and everything that you need to make that happen. And then the camps were raided, and it was a really horrible thing. And so we were really having a setback with planning because of everything that was happening at the camps. But we just still continued to move forward because we had already picked a date. And so it was just a really busy, crazy, almost, you know, just hard time to do the planning, but then to also see just how bad it did turn out when the Army National Guard and the police did move in by gunpoint and forcibly removed everybody. So all of that happened, but at the same time, once the event came and we were all together in DC last week, it was like a family reunion, and it did really lift up everyone's spirits again, because the whole idea was always behind the fact that what we did at Standing Rock was much more than just a physical encampment. It had to do with, you know, the fight that's been ongoing for over 500 years anyways, about sustainability and about not continuing to take and take and take from the earth without ever giving anything back. And so the idea was, what's next? We're all together. We're here in D.C. What are the next steps? And it was really helping to ensure that people were connecting with each other that maybe didn't connect in Standing Rock, that people understood how to lobby their congressmen and congresswomen on the Hill in D.C., and that people understood that the power lies in the people. And so I think we were really successful at all of that. The whole idea was not to just do a march and rally, but to do a four-day event with a teepee encampment, which included lobby visits and included, you know, speaking and panels and performances and song and arts and culture, ceremony, all of that rolled into a four-day event. And we had originally been expecting maybe 500 people that were going to be able to make it to D.C. for the march. And then we thought, oh, I think we're going to get a couple of thousand. And when all was said and done, we know that there was at least 5,000 people that marched with us on Friday. And I don't even know the full numbers yet of how many came through altogether during the whole four-day event. But I feel like it was a great success, and it led people to work on all of the other pipeline fights, because we do have Keystone XL back on, you know, because of Donald Trump. And so there's already camp. There's a camp in South Dakota already near Cheyenne River, near the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, I should say, in South Dakota. And they're working on, you know, fighting again, just the same way they did before, because the Dakota Access Pipeline encampment, all of that was as a result of the success we had with Keystone XL. And so now all the people are going back to Keystone XL to continue to fight that. But There are people going to the Two Rivers camp in Texas to fight against the Trans-Pecos pipeline, which is the same company, Energy Transfer Partners.
Yeah.
But more importantly, to continue to the Dakota Access Pipeline fight, a lot of people are going to Louisiana, where a camp is being set up against the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. And the Bayou Bridge Pipeline is the one that will connect to the Dakota Access Pipeline in Illinois.
Yeah.
So that the oil can continue to go down to Port Arthur, Texas, where it will be refined and then shipped to foreign markets.
Right.
So it's kind of all part of the same project.
Yeah.
And a lot of people didn't understand that until they went to DC and saw the different panels and saw the different information and made that connection that we need to continue the fight. It's so much bigger than Standing Rock and one pipeline. In addition to that, we're doing arranging toxic tours and having people come to North Dakota to see the Bakken,
right,
and the shale oil formation, so that they can see where the oil is coming from and to help push for bans and moratoriums on fracking.
Right.
And we have the economy on our side too.
Yeah.
As we've been saying all along, the price of oil has been dropping and dropping. There's going to be a slight increase, we know, here in 2017, but not what they've been touting for the last 2 years. For the last 2 years, they've been telling oil industry folks, wait until 2017, then everything's going to be great again. And we know that not to be true. And so even economically, it's our, you know, it's on our side, but we still have to continue to push and fight back, because there was a new shale oil formation that was found in Texas. I don't know how new it is, but it's been recently released that there's a lot of oil in Texas. And yeah. So that means that it'll take the pressure off of North Dakota, but it's not a NIMBY issue. You know, I'm glad, being from North Dakota, that's happening, but I'm not glad because it's not going away.
Right.
It's going somewhere else. And in the big picture, that doesn't help any of us. And so that's why I really want to go personally myself to Texas.
Yeah.
And I want to go to the Two Rivers camp. That's my next goal, is because we just have to continue until, you know, we have to continue pushing for the just transition.
Right.
And so we are going to build the mini Wichoni sustained community, but we're working with the tribe at Standing Rock to see exactly how big we can go with that and what that looks like. Because we did have a delay with the result of everything that happened, and the community members there are really tired of the militarized police force and different non-BIA officers even now that are on the reservation because of cross-deputization and jurisdiction. And so everybody's really touchy right now. And so we understand, and we're, you know, the project is still fully funded and it's slightly on hold, just making sure that everybody understands. So continued educational forums about what it means to have a community that is based upon gray water systems and solar and wind, and to understand that it's not another encampment. It's what we had always talked about since as far back as August and September, leaving something behind for the community that's not for the camps. It's not for the out-of-state people. It's for Standing Rock and for their children and for future generations. We also have since extended that conversation up to Fort Berthold, to the head of the Black Snake, to do a sustained community there as well. So we are working with a member of the tribal council to talk about how big of a scale of a community we can put there too. And so not only stopping these energy projects, but showing what we mean when we say just transition.
Yeah.
By just doing it.
Yeah.
By just making it happen.
There is so much going on right now. I want to go back a little bit to the forced removal from Standing Rock. And you know, I think a lot of people were paying attention very closely up and around the election, and then the election took everybody's attention off. And so a lot of people don't really know the story of what led up to the removal. So could you give us a little bit more background there?
Well, what had happened was the state had waged a really good campaign for themselves.
Yeah,
it wasn't
right.
good for us. To cause divisionary tactics within the Standing Rock Sioux tribe and then the people that were there at the camps. And they did that by blocking the bridge on Highway 1806.
Mm-hmm.
When they blocked the bridge, that caused the casino revenue to dip greatly, because a lot of people would go from Bismarck down to the Prairie Nights Casino. It also caused community members to have to be forced to go around to get up to the hospital, ambulances, what have you. They all had to go around and couldn't take Highway 1806 to Bismarck. The other thing that happened was that because of the fight at Standing Rock, a lot of the sort of hidden racism that was always there in North Dakota. I mean, I grew up there,
yeah.
So I always experienced it. But when Standing Rock came about, it just became more and more blatant because of the actions that were being done in Bismarck to say, look, this is affecting you too. This is impacting you too.
Right.
Of all the people, you in Bismarck should care the most because you didn't want this either. But what that did was it called out the racism. And so there were things like school children, when they would go on their high school basketball games or the boys and girls teams, their different sports events were getting harassed. And they actually had to have escorts follow them to their basketball games because whether or not the children said anything about the pipeline fight, they were, you know, they were just going to a game, they would get harassed by the other kids and by their parents. And all of these things were causing further and further and further division, I mean, amongst the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe communities and the encampments themselves. There was a lot of non-Native people, really well-meaning non-Native people that came to stay in the camp. And there was a lot of different things that were happening in the camp. And so as a result, what happened in January, I think it was like January 20th, there was a resolution that was passed by the community of Cannonball, which is the closest community, and that was signed on by, I think, a majority of the council people.
Yeah.
Four of the council people agreed, you know, abstained, and then one didn't vote at all, and that was Dave Archambault, the chairman. He didn't vote at all.
Yeah.
He didn't have to, only if there was a tiebreaker. So he never even voted or did any of these things that was blamed for forcibly removing the camps. But what it was the community saying, we're tired. And we appreciate that you were here. And now we're asking you to go home so that we can continue this battle legally in the court systems, because essentially we've lost. They never stopped. They continued building all the way up. They got the easement. So by the time Donald Trump was in there and by the time he was saying he was going to build it, the communities were tired. And all of this to me was totally understandable. The people on the ground, however, we're like, how could the tribe do this to us? How could David Archambault tell us that we can't be here anymore? You know, we've lived here for 3 months. How dare you tell us we have to leave?
Yeah.
So that's what it all caused, was a division between the and people on the ground and people in the communities. And it was a battle that was waged against the people based upon that bridge being blocked and the police telling the Standing Rock Sioux tribe that we will not remove this barricade until the camps are cleared. They absolutely refused to move the barricade until the camps were cleared. And so I think it was kind of a catch-22. They were in a rock and a hard place. At the same time, it was hard that it got blamed on the tribe when that land is all along was Army Corps of Engineer land all along, even though right. technically it's not, because it's treaty land.
Right.
Because of the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty. So those that chose to take a stand did so on the treaty angle, which was perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
It was a moment to say, you need to honor our treaty. And so there was all these different sides and all these different angles, but all of it caused a little bit of dissension amongst different groups and maybe a little bit of division. And we could kind of see that. I could kind of see that happening. And I was like, how are we going to move forward in a positive way to continue these next steps leading up to what we're going to do beyond the camp being taken down? So the negotiations were made that everybody would have plenty of time, and that's when this date of February 22nd was set.
Yeah.
And it was set kind of early on to where people had, you know, weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. I know that, you know, we went in and we took down our yurts and we did a cleanup campaign, which had only been going on for 2 or 3 weeks. You have to imagine a city that was once the size of 15,000 people trying to clean that up in the snow.
Yeah.
It was time consuming. But what the press did and what they really glommed onto was, oh, these water protectors are polluting and destroying the river by being there.
Yeah.
Instead of taking, you know, took all of the energy and attention away from the fact that there's an oil pipeline with carcinogenic materials running through it, and said it was us that was polluting the river. And of course, the people of North Dakota attached onto that And it became this thing where we were the ones that were the problem. And so that caused further division, which made it really hard for us because it was like, how can the media twist or spin this anymore than they already were before? And that they just grabbed onto that. And so we were cleaning up for 2 or 3 weeks. And then when we were forcibly removed, we had to stop because they were like, get out of here. And then they said, we had to clean this. It's all their fault. And it's like, you forced us out at gunpoint. But so all of that led up to how the military, I mean, it wasn't just the police coming in and moving people out. It was armed vehicles and people wearing riot gear and the army, like the our own army, the United States Army, again, was came in fully geared up with rifles and machine guns and tanks and came against unarmed water protectors. And they had made it sound like they were going to find weapons or something. And so later on, the sheriff of Morton County, Kyle Kirschmeyer, had to put out a report that said we did not find any weapons in the camp. And we were like, well, of course you didn't. We've been saying this all along, you know, and but they put it in a really racist, syndicated, local way that said, but there was other things. And I was, I put out a, on my own Facebook page, I was teasing them saying, oh, did they find my cache of snowballs? Because that was one of the things they complained about, was that people threw snowballs at them with their machine guns pointed at us. All of that still exists in this country.
Yeah.
In the United States, still in 2017, it's not like what happened to the Native American people in the history books. It is what is continuing to happen. And it really woke up the country. In fact, it woke up the world to see that this does exist.
Yeah.
And that the United States isn't just one almighty entity against the rest of the world, but that we're broken down into factions within our own country.
Yeah.
And that it's founded upon a legacy of the taking, pillaging, raping of native lands for the gain of capitalism and colonization. And so other countries were on board with us and standing with standing. We're still getting all these tweets and all these pictures because people understand that there is a population within the United States now that still exists.
Right.
They just assume that natives were in the history books and that was it. And so how do we continue that fight on? And it's to say, no more fossil fuel industry anywhere, anywhere in the world, and to not allow the United States to be the bullies that we have been anymore, and show that there is a better way for us to live. It's really ridiculous that all these other countries are on board with changing their energy systems and changing their transportation systems, and yet the United States keeps holding on to oil and gas and coal and uranium. And it affects other countries because of that need or that greed for the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it affects them in a negative way.
One of the things that everybody that I spoke with when I was out there stressed was to talk about what was going on in the camp and in the context of native sovereignty and of decolonization. So I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
The way that the camp started, first of all, was with the youth.
Yeah.
They had a vision and a goal and a dream because of the fact that suicide rates in our communities is so high.
Yeah.
I mean, it is so devastating that so many kids would rather kill themselves than to deal with the hurt and the transgenerational trauma that has happened over the years.
Right.
So when we talk about the camp, we have to include a history that comes along with how it began and why. It was amazing to see youth like Jocelyn Charger and Bobby Jean Three Lakes and other youth that decided to do these runs where they ran in their own community. It was just a few miles and they were like, this is fun. We should organize another run. And then that's when they called up and included the Indigenous Environmental Network. We had helped them with their first run just for food and funding. It was just a really small scale.
Yeah.
And they said, we want to go further. And I was like, okay, well, how about Nebraska, the Army Corps of Engineers offices? And so my partner or my coworker, Dallas Boltooth, was really helping to say, yeah, let's make it happen. So all we did was make a few phone calls for solidarity housing, food along the way, gas, you know, for the vans that were going to be following the runners. And they successfully ran to Nebraska. Which then they said, we want to keep running. And then they ran to DC. And they did it because dealing with pain and trauma was something that was always a secret. It was always kept quiet. It was always pushed under the rug. And in doing this run, they were able to connect with each other as youth with the pain that they were having in their own households, in their own communities, that their grandpas and grandmas experienced. When everybody had gone to boarding schools and during this termination era that the United States government had, it was pretty terrible for our grandparents and our great-grandparents. They were beaten, they were abused, they were stripped of clothing even to change the way they dressed, and then language was stripped, and then there was a lot of molestation that actually happened in these boarding schools. What ended up happening is that degree of negativity carried on through the generations to where we had uncles or different family members that carried on that type of negativity to their own family members. And youth started understanding that this wasn't because of their grandparents or their grandparents, it was because of a system that was broken, that brainwashed. This was the first generation to understand that they could potentially forgive their own abusers because of what happened to them when they were young. And this movement allowed people to see the youth weren't going to take it anymore. The millennials of this generation were going to change it by speaking out about it and not keeping it a dirty secret or not keeping it silent. And it really allowed the youth something to grab onto other than suicide as the only way out.
Yeah.
So there's a whole historical context that's more than just the camps. And so then you have all of that history and then you come to the camp. And that is how it started, was the youth wanting to say, we forgive you for doing this as your job, construction workers. And here's some water. Water is life. We know that you don't want to be here. We know that you're just doing this as your job. So they just started to gather out there and stand in front of equipment. And then the company, Energy Transfer Partner, ran out of patience, you know, in May and June and July. So when August came, it was when we got the 24-hour or 48-hour notice that they were going to start constructing the first road that was going to cut across Cannonball Ranch, which is also treaty land, and cut down to the river. And we knew that there were sacred sites out there. That's when people first started seeing the arrest. They started seeing us standing on the barricades, standing in front of the equipment, breaking down fences and running out and jumping on equipment. And that's when the rest of the nation started to get involved. That's when they started to see violence, unfortunately. But it was really good. It was mostly Native people at that time. What ended up happening in November, December, January was that the movement started to move away from the youth and started to move away from how we had begun into more of an ally space. Totally well-meaning allies, but not fully understanding that cultural significance of nonviolent direct action that we were in this fight with. Because they were people that came that wanted to fight the police. There were people that came that wanted to get angry and had their own trauma, you know, from their own blood memory that they were bringing into the camps with them. So it's a multi-layered struggle. The biggest problem was that we could not identify who the people in the camps were that were not actually on our side versus the ones that were, because the camp became infiltrated with people that were working for the police and people that were working for the Dakota Access Pipeline. Even right now, there's an FBI task force, terrorism task force, that is basically harassing some of the water protectors. And there are three of us that we know for sure that are being investigated by the FBI terrorism task force. But this is not new. If you go back to the 1970s and to Wounded Knee, this all happened then too, except for Leonard Peltier is still in prison 40 years later for a crime that everybody is convinced he never committed. It's important to understand the history.
Yeah. Going back to the events in DC this week and moving forward from there, you talked about all of these other camps and all of this other stuff. How can people keep up with these different camps and with the movement and be supportive in ways that are helpful and not and not hurtful, perhaps?
Yeah, it's always important to be in the community where you're at and respect the community, even if you don't agree with them. So with the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe community, when they had respectfully requested people to leave, people should have left. To respect what the community wants, no matter where you go. It's like going into somebody's house when they invite you in and then they say, okay, good night. And they're like, okay, well, I'm not leaving. I'm staying here. So I think that's the first and foremost. When a call goes out, if a call goes out for people to join, then they should. A call went out at Two Rivers Camp in Texas. A call went out at the Sable Pipeline fight in Florida. A call went out in Louisiana for people to come and stand with them. So that's great. The other thing that people should continue to work on, even if they can't go to a camp, is the defund campaign and the divestment campaign, because that has been extremely successful. And we have defunddapple.org, which shows you the 17 banks that are funding these projects. Yeah. But you have to think about it. It goes even larger than those 17 banks, because a lot of these large banks are funding an energy project somewhere. So no matter what a person or who they bank with, we're always still continually asking people to take their money out of these big banks and to put them into their local community credit unions. Yeah. And to bring back the power to your community. And that's part of the big picture anyways, is because we need to go back into our own communities and restabilize our own communities at that small scale level. That takes away a lot of the power and a lot of the money that the corporate interests have to use. It's our money that they're using to fund these projects. And so having people understand the power that we have as individuals, because they don't. And this Standing Rock, Stand with Standing Rock thing that happened showed people that, oh, we do actually have a lot of power. We didn't realize it. So we're continuing to push for the divestment campaign, and we're continuing to have people push back against the Donald Trump administration pushing for fossil fuel resources. And the way that we want people to do that is by, in your own community, having community gardens and having local community education events that talk about how you can be more sustainable. And if that means not having strawberries in December, depending on where you live, then so be it. So food sovereignty and transportation systems are all tied into it.
Yeah.
And I think that it's going to be more trial and error as we move through it. Yeah. Because that's just human nature. There's going to be trial and error between what we should do, what we shouldn't do. But as long as we're moving in that direction, that's good. And then another component of this, another layer in addition to doing grassroots work, is to get involved in the politics. And I know that's hard for some people because they hate it. I used to hate politics myself because I felt like they didn't represent me. Yeah. And they won't represent you unless you make your voice clearly heard that, you know, in your town, in your community, in your state, that this is what you do or don't want within your own state. And then to make sure that those people that are in these positions, these elected officials, hear and understand what you're saying when it comes to what you do or do not want in your communities. So I'm from North Dakota, and we're battling with all of these really ridiculous laws where they're trying to make it impossible for us to get any they're trying to ban any wind projects from moving forward for 2 years so that they can bring back coal projects.
Right.
And so we have to just, I have to talk to my family and say, hey, family, write this letter. Here's a letter for you. Just sign it. You know, like whatever it takes to get people involved and get aware of the issues in your own communities, we have to impact politics. And if that's not good enough, then people should run. Yeah. People should run for our positions, official positions, if they want to make change. And so we always encourage that too in our communities.
And how can people keep up with you and with the Indigenous Environmental Network?
Well, we have our web pages. We have ienearth.org as well as indigenousrising.org. We have our Twitter. We can tweet us at ienearth. Indigenous EnviroNet is our other Twitter. We have our Facebook pages, Indigenous Rising Media and Indigenous Environmental Network. And then I have all my own personal pages under my name as well, Kendi Mossett. I'm on Twitter at MHAWEA. Really, what I'm trying to do is work my way out of a job. I don't have to do this anymore. I have one. Woo!
I hear you.
I really have a passion and a goal in my life, and that is to not ever have a phone again or a computer again. I don't have to worry about charging and plugging in and people knowing where to find me at any time. So I'm trying to work my way out of the job. And in the meantime, you know, I'm just going to continue. I have a 3-year-old. And so every spring we're getting our garden planned again. I'm teaching her how to grow food, teaching her, you know, where we find our own berries, where we find our ground berries at home, where we find turnips, what it looks like, what the plant on the top looks like, where you dig. And I think it's important for people everywhere to know that, even in the cities, what used to be there, what could be just outside the city, what kind of resources can you find? And so that's kind of like my continuation. And I hope one day to just be, you know, in the country somewhere with my garden and with my daughter and just kind of living a more relaxed pace. But right now it's really urgent and people need organizers, or I feel like they need people kind of like us that are trying to spread the message of sustainability by talking about it, but also showing it. So I'm going to continue the community gardens and continue the local cooperative work, getting people to invest in their own co-op. And hopefully, you know, one day when I'm older, I won't have to worry as much, but I just don't know. This seems like this might definitely be a battle for my lifetime.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Fayebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.